This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
And welcome to one of our author interview episodes. Tonight we are very excited to be joined by author Bradley P. Bollier. He's a great author and a podcaster as well. He is part of the podcasting family. So let's jump right into the interview.
Connection established.
And we are joined right now by Bradley P. Bollier. Hopefully I'm saying that right. Did I do a good job?
That's pretty darn close.
Bollier.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm excited.
So now it says on your profile that you actually took a little bit of time off from writing right after college. So what finally brought you back into it full time?
Well, I just dabbled with it in the college days. I wasn't terribly serious about it. I was really fixed on computer science and getting into that field. I eventually worked at a nuclear power plant in Northern Illinois.
Wow.
Moved on to some other...
In Clinton?
In Zion, Illinois, actually.
In Zion, okay. I'm from Southern Illinois, so...
Oh, okay. And that was a fun, life. And then I moved on to consulting, where I traveled quite a bit. And it was actually when I was traveling a bit that I had more time on my hands. So I'd be on planes, in hotels, working for different customers, for different gigs I was working on, that I started to toy with the idea again. And then that took me several years worth of just kind of petering around with things. And I figured I really better do this thing or stop, mm-hmm. One of the two, because it was taking a lot of time. And then I got more serious in around 2003 or so, 2002 in there. And I started going to more workshops. I went to a gaming convention, Gen Con, held in Milwaukee for a long time, in Kenosha, where I grew up, and now Indy. And Kish Johnson was one of the teachers there, along with some others. And she started talking about entering contests, going to more workshops, and trying to get to build your skills, so to speak. And that's when I started taking it more seriously.
And so were you always a fan of science fiction and fantasy, or was that something that kind of developed over time?
For sure, I was a fan of science fiction and fantasy, and especially fantasy. I stumbled across one of my friends. I remember his name still. In third grade, Jim Vogt hit me to the Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit first, and I just loved it. I just fell in love with the whole depth of the world, the breadth of it. And I certainly did read some science fiction as well, but really fell in love with fantasy, and especially that type, epic fantasy. And so I'd probably read, 75% fantasy. So that's been my love for sure. And mostly high fantasy, epic fantasy, that type of tale.
What tell us a little bit about your series, The Lays of Onuskaya. Is that how you say it?
That's exactly right.
Oh, wow. I totally guessed.
Nice.
It starts with The Winds of Kalakovo?
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the elevator pitch that I give is that it's a Song of Ice and Fire meets Earthsea with a Russian twist.
Wow.
And so it's, the epic fantasy is George Martin-esque. It's, big and sprawling. And the Earthsea angle is not so much the writing, but the world, the milieu a little bit. There's a set of archipelagos upon which these grand duchies, duchies of one grand duchy, live. And they're kind of modeled after a Muscovite Russia. And the story is about a prince of the realm, a duke of Kalakovo, the son of a duke, and he comes across a boy who may have the ability to heal a blight that's been sweeping through the islands and causing death and disease, and nobody can figure out why. He discovers that this boy may have the ability to heal the blight, but also that a splinter sect of people are trying to use the same boy to cause widespread devastation. And so the story opens with, in the Winds of Kalakovo, as a tug of war between the prince and this radical group to try to unlock the boy's secrets before the other one does.
I really liked your book trailer for this, mm-hmm. and the use of the, was that like public domain medieval art or
Renaissance art?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or yeah. A lot. Renaissance, right? Well, that's actually an interesting story because I went to way back in 2004 was kind of the genesis of this whole series. I went on this whirlwind trip with my wife to England and Scotland and then Ireland. And we stopped in Edinburgh when we were running through that city, and we went to the National Gallery of Scotland, and they had a number of just beautiful paintings from these Dutch masters and Scottish masters. And I decided I was going to take some of them and use them to create my next series, which ended up being The Winds of Kalakovo. And so I picked up a bunch of postcards while I was there, and I actually still have them right by my desk.
Huh.
And I used those in the creation of the story, but then I used them again in that trailer. So a number of the characters that you see in that were like direct influences on who they became in the story. So you see the boy blowing on a brand in the trailer, and that's mm-hmm. Nassim, this little savant boy that the Prince of Kalakovo comes across.
That's great, because I really felt, and I thought maybe I was just imagining it, but I like pattern recognition, but I really felt like, wow, he found art that really matches what they're trying to convey in the trailer about the story seemingly really well. And it turns out that there's a really, really good reason behind that. That's really cool to know.
Yeah. There's a number of fun little things that came up in that. You'll see quickly a girl who's very serious looking, and she has a tear in her eye, and that became a woman who has secrets, let's say. I don't want to give anything away, but that tear was what got me to that point.
Hmm.
And Nassim blowing on that brand led to almost the entirety of the magic system that I was coming up with as well, and his story too. So it was really neat taking those and using them to generate the story ideas.
Now, that would be a great thing to have to look at while you're either reading or especially with audiobooks. Sometimes I go and I try to find pictures to look at while I'm listening to the audiobook. That'd be the perfect companion. Yeah, I did. It's great with something like Cloud Atlas, where somebody has created a website where they're showing the locations. It really, really helps to kind of give your eyes something that's complementary to what you're reading.
Now, I was, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I read somewhere, I'm not sure if it was Amazon or not, but that this boy that you're talking about is autistic. Is that something you intended, or are people interpreting it that way?
Well, he has autistic-like symptoms. In the first book, I wanted him to be a key figure throughout the whole series, and he is. And he ended up being a boy who has wondrous powers. And as I started to kind of fold him into the story a little bit, it started getting difficult. You want to be really wary when you have truly powerful characters. You almost always have to limit them in some way. And the way that I thought of for him was that he was in fact reborn. He is one of the three wizards we find out that caused the devastation that we're seeing as the story opens up. And through the story, he starts to understand more and more about his prior life. And through that, he starts to gain more and more control over himself and his abilities. And so he's not autistic in our sense of the word, but he definitely has those kinds of symptoms that that Prince Nicander has to sort of work through as he's trying to discover the boy's secrets.
Well, we have some listener questions. We'll start off with one from Michael, who wants to ask, what's your process like for developing the interconnected civilizations of your fantasy worlds? And he wants to know also any tips for other writers looking to do sophisticated world building.
Yeah, well, I have changed how I approach this type of thing over the years. It used to be that I would kind of work the world up a little bit, try to figure out, you know, what the cultures were in play, what the characters a little bit, but not to any great degree. And then I would start writing. And I wrote several trunk novels this way. And in the last couple of series, including Winds of Kalakovo and the new series that I just sold to DAW, I got I put a lot more effort into figuring out what the world is like, where things lie, what the backgrounds are between the different cultures, their histories, their flare points, the things they like about one another. And only then, when I start feeling like I have a handle on that and the magic system and the world at large, will I really dig into the characters, because that advises me a lot on who they are, how they will react, maybe how they're different from their, say, stock culture, their vanilla culture, what differences do they have, and how can that play against, you know, the story that's unfolding. So I tend to spend a lot more time than I used to, and it's hard to say exactly how much time you need to spend, because you can go overboard. But I just want to feel comfortable in the world and have it feel rich before I start diving in. So that's the best advice I can give.
Who do you kind of see as like an inspiration for world building, especially these days?
Well, you know, I would go back to Tolkien for one. Although he spent, you know, a ton of time, 15 plus years on Lord of the Rings after spending a lot of time on The Hobbit in the first place. So, you know, that's maybe a bit much for me. I'm not going to go to the length of creating languages, although I'll create words and try to get a feel.
We know a guy, if you need a language. Yes.
Is that the guy that did the Game of Thrones,
the Dothraki?
Yes, David J. Peterson, who did Dothraki, and he also did all the alien languages for, what's the name of that show?
Defiance.
Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, I've thought about that guy, because I read about him, of course, when the show was coming out, getting ready to come out, and he was developing Dothraki and the other ones. And I read what he did with Martins, and I've heard Martin speak on this too. Like, he doesn't come up with whole languages. He comes up with things that he needs when he needs them. And that's what I do as well. And I was thinking, man, would I look like an idiot if somebody came and like looked at my, you know, little bits and pieces of language? Is it completely off base, or would it work or not? I don't know. But that's amazing that he can do that.
He would probably make it into something awesome, no matter what. Because he's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, I
suppose.
I remember only thing he was a little concerned or a little irritated by is Khaleesi is not supposed to be pronounced that way, but everyone wants to pronounce it that way, and the showrunners were like, no, it's Khaleesi. I think by the time he had gotten in, they had already kind of gotten the habit. I can't remember. I don't want to get it wrong. It was something like Khaleesi or something.
Oh, yeah. One of the things that I do is I have strong Russian influence in the Winds of Kalakovo books, and also medieval Persian and Ottoman Turkey. And so I found these online dictionaries that have transliterations from Russian and Persian and Turkish. And so when I'm coming up with new names, or say the names of ships, the wind ships in the Lays of Onoskaya series, I'll look at words that are translated, then try to use that for the feel of the word. So I actually suspect I'm not doing too bad with what I'm working on, but
not too far off, I'm sure.
Hopefully.
Steve wants to know, you have had success with traditional publishing, Kickstarters, short stories, podcasting, and more. What do you see as the most effective ways to bring your work to fans? Are there any trends you are seeing that will become more prevalent?
Well, you know, I've done these Kickstarters, and the first one was for a short story collection. And that one to me is kind of a no-brainer. It's hard to get short story collections and even anthologies. The markets are really slim for these. The big publishers just aren't doing a lot of those these days.
Yeah.
And the second one I did because I had a little falling out with my old publisher. But you know, the biggest advice that I suppose I could give is to work on your craft, because none of that stuff, like either trying to get in with traditional publishing or trying to go out on your own, is going to work unless your basic craft is there. You have to get to a sufficient level before you can really take off. It's just not going to happen otherwise. I would suggest getting out there. I always tell people to go, and if you can get in a local critique group, that's great. But I actually prefer online critique groups, getting to know other writers and trading online just via email. Getting together in person. I do that kind of once a year. I'll get together with writers and critique our work. And so, you know, pay attention to your craft, you know, very closely until you get to a certain point. And then you can start making more decisions about which way you want to go.
Now, you mentioned earlier about the Russian inspiration, and Ben submitted a question. He wanted to know what draws you to Russian and Slavic myths and legends as the basis and inspiration for that series.
You know, at first, when I first started working on it, I just had those paintings. I didn't know where it was going. And I actually used a program called Fractal Terrains to generate the world. And you can use that to generate, you know, different maps, different portions of the world. And you can set up different parameters, like the size of the world, how large the land mass versus water mass, number of moons, water coverage, temperatures, everything. And you can kind of regenerate it several times. And I knew that I wanted to have this these islands. And then I stumbled across making them kind of cold and inhospitable. And it was sort of a natural leap from there to Russian. I wanted something that was not typical, quote-unquote, you know, Western European story. I wanted something different. And so that kind of lent itself towards that as well. And also I kind of, I grew up in, you know, largely the 80s and my teens, and was affected by the Cold War quite a bit. Then I always felt like, you know, I had no problem with them personally. And it was this long running thing that made me wonder about them, what it was like on the other side. And all that kind of added up a little bit to, sort of exploring the Russian angle, and as I did, I liked it more and more. And then I started pulling in the Persian and Ottoman influences just to have different cultural roles in play in the story. And I liked the sort of flavor that it created in the story as I started working on it.
It's funny you say that, because I grew up in the 80s too. I don't know if they made you watch The Day After in school like they did for
yes.
us. Yeah.
Yeah.
That, it really, really affects how you see the world. And I ended up studying Russian language in college for a few years for that same reason, just because I was curious about that culture that we had been warned off of for my entire life. And then, of course, everything changes, the communists fall. And now I feel like I don't understand, because I learned about them while they were still the Soviet Union, and I really don't understand what's going on over there. Studying this part of their history, do you feel like you have an insight of why the Russian culture is doing the things that it does today?
Well, you know, I've been asked about this a fair bit. I actually didn't use a lot from Russian history in terms of the history of my world. Mm-hmm. What I did instead was try to take the flavor of that culture, you know, some of the touch points, some of the food, clothing, weapons, those types of things, and then apply a different sort of framework to it. And that framework, frankly, was the Gulf War and the conflicts in the Middle East. That stuff affected me a lot.
Sure.
And you know, as it did everybody. And I wanted to explore something where different cultures were on different sides of a divide. And if they... they were certainly fixed in their views, but I felt like one of the things I really wanted to explore was if you could see the other side, if you were taken to that other side, maybe even forcibly, what might happen? If you could see it from their point of view, you know, what could we accomplish? And that's a lot of what I tried to do in exploring my own feelings about, you know, the conflict in the Middle East.
All right. And then we had a question from Ryan, who wants to know, I hear you are working on a new book called 12 Kings in Sharakai. Can you tell us anything about this book? And also, did I say that one right?
Yes, you did. Exactly.
Yes.
So 12 Kings in Sharakai is a new series that I sold to Daw in the US and Galance in the UK. I'm set to turn it in, the first book, in just a couple of months. I'm almost done with the first draft at this point. And it's a story about, I wanted to tell an epic fantasy story from a single point of view. I'm a huge fan of George Martin. And I do like the multi-POV thing, which I did in The Lays of Onoskaya, but I kind of wanted to take a different tack in this series. So it's a story about a young female pit fighter who rises up to challenge the rule of the kings of the desert, who have ruled with an iron fist for some 400 years. And it's a story that starts out with her finding clues to the power that the kings hold through a book that her mother has left her before she died. And the story is kind of, it unfolds as she starts to learn more and more about these riddles within these poems that her mother has left her. And then things start to get crazy as she does learn more about them and uses what she learns.
Now, you have written a novella called Strata that was more in the science fiction vein as well. Were you just ready to do something in the sci-fi space, or just wanted to take on a different kind of challenge?
Yeah, I do write a fair number of short stories. I have, a couple dozen that I've written. And although I don't, at least I haven't found an idea so far that I've wanted to explore that's novel length, I do enjoy writing it. I do enjoy reading it. And the person that I wrote it with, Steve Gaskell, he's a great writer, mostly science fiction writer. And I went to Clarion with him back in 2006. And part of that whole thing was just to have a shared experience with, a fellow writer, somebody who I respect, somebody who I think that we don't write exactly alike, but enough that I think we could work together and learn from each other and have just a fun experience. And that's what it ended up being. But the story itself turned out to be really cool. I think it turned out great.
What's it about?
It is about a young boy who is, this is set on a solar mining platform, and there's several of these that circle the sun and gather energy from within the sun and beam it back to Earth via microwaves. And the life on the station is not what people thought it was when they signed up. It becomes akin to slavery because you can't get out after a certain point. You have to pay for more and more things like, medical care, and that counts against your trip back to Earth. And so it's a story about a boy and a teacher who are part of a pod racing team. They race over the surface of the sun, and they incite a revolution on these solar platforms.
Very cool.
As one does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It
took some pod racing and it made it cool. I like that.
Yeah.
We've got one last question that we always want to ask authors, but I want to slip in one repeat question, which is, you mentioned the program that you used, the Fractal program you used for laying out terrains. What was that again?
Fractal Terrains.
Fractal Terrain. Oh, well, that's why terrain was in my head. There you go. Fractal Terrains.
Yeah.
That sounds fascinating. I was curious if that gave you the spire formation, or if that was something you had already planned to do and you pulled it out of the terrain itself.
It did to a degree, because I wanted there to be, it actually goes back to the wind chips and how they work. I wanted them to be modeled somewhat after how waterborne crafts cut through the water with a keel. And the spires are these big towers, these obsidian towers that control and sort of manage and form the ley lines that run between the different islands. And those allow the ships to run between islands and not just float on the wind like a seed. They can actually cut against it, so to speak, to run through the ley lines like a keel would through water on a waterborne ship.
Cool.
So yeah, it did have a kind of a direct effect, actually.
Our last question, we always want to know, for those in the audience who are aspiring writers, and you've actually touched on a little bit of this, what are your tips for people? What would you say to people who want to become new writers? You were mentioning about working on your craft. How should they go about working on their craft, do you think?
Well, first of all, get out there, write your stuff, finish what you write, of course, and then get it out to people. And I think, I always like to talk about my Clarion experience. I went back in 2006, and one of my teachers was Chip Delaney, Samuel R. Delaney. And he told us that it isn't sufficient to simply write. You have to actively look for your strengths and your weaknesses, especially weaknesses, and work at them, because otherwise they are just loose muscles that will remain loose. So one of the things I always recommend is to, as you're getting your feedback, on your own writing, and looking at other people's work and seeing the blind spots that you have, make excuses to work on those things. This is why short stories, to me, is such a great form, at least for the learning writer, because you can take those things and use that as a story challenge. So if you're not so great at dialogue or you're not so great at exposition, you can make stories that are heavy on those just to work those out. And over time, what you'll find is that in the beginning, you're very conscious of what you're trying to do, and you're clumsy. You think about the rules constantly. And when you go back, it's the same thing when you revise those stories. But as you go on, the next time you do it, you'll think about that a little bit less, and the next time a little bit less, until eventually it's all internalized. I mean, you don't have to think about those things anymore. But it has to begin with looking for, finding, recognizing your weaknesses, and then challenging them with writing.
That is such great advice.
That's great. That's really great advice. Yeah.
Well, especially because I think for most people, the advice of write every day is good advice to get you to start writing every day. But that is perfect advice for those people who are like, okay, I've gotten over the excuses not to write. What do I do now?
Yeah, right.
What's next? That's great. Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us. And where can our listeners follow your work online?
Thanks for having me. You can find more about me at quillings.com. That's QUILLINGS.com. And if I can put in a quick plug for a fellow podcast, I run the Speculate podcast, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans. And we're at SpeculateSF.com.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And if you guys out there want to get in touch with us, our email address is feedback@SwordAndLaser. The website is SwordAndLaser.com. All of our discussions happen over on Goodreads.com. And if you want to leave a voicemail, the phone number is 415-7-SWORD-6. We'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Oh, and by the way, we are launching, finally, a Kickstarter campaign to support season 2 of the Sword and Laser video show. So, hey guys, put your money where your mouth is. If you want to see season number 2, head over to swordandlaser.com/Kickstarter to learn more. It will be launching on Thursday. That is Thursday, October 24th. The page will go live then, so keep your eyes peeled. Thank you so much.